everybody in prison. We're living with this thing that I'm going to take revenge on the snitch. I'm going to take revenge on the people. And you sat there with those men, just livid. And then you'd say, yeah, but I did it. I did throw the punch. But you also felt really guilty.
Yeah.
Because you know what the men were going back to.
Yeah. My name is Jacob Dunn. I'm an author, campaigner, an educator in restorative justice. In 2011, I threw a single punch that ended another man's life. And after 14 months in prison, I found myself homeless, unemployed, and struggling to find a sense of purpose. But I managed to get my life back on track. And now I help others do the same. Join me on this first season of Right From Wrong, where I speak to the people who were instrumental in my journey from punishment to redemption. This is Right From Wrong. As always, it's a pleasure to welcome you back to Right From Wrong. This episode marks the end of one story and the beginning of another. We have come a long way from bad choices and bad cultures to the moment that changed the course of not just my life, but the lives of countless others. We've been through prison to probation to facing the challenges of education. And today we'll talk about the new chapter in my life, the ongoing work of making a right from wrong with restorative justice. Today, I'll talk with Sandra, the person who has helped me discover my purpose and gave me the tools to help me make a right from a wrong. But let me tell you how we first came to meet. I had been out of prison for about a year and was speaking under the fake name of Tony to protect my identity. I stood at a podium delivering my first ever keynote speech. I'd never worn a suit before, but decided to buy one especially for this conference. My keynote speech was about restorative justice, which is a life-changing process of hearing from my victims and answering their questions. There was someone in the crowd, a victim of a racial attack. His name was Shad Ali. He had also been through the restorative justice process, albeit from the other side. And he was also sharing the benefits he had found from going through this process with the man that attacked him. It's fair to say we got on like a house on fire. Shad was already working for the Forgiveness Project in the Restore Prison Program. He encouraged me to get involved. This is where I met Sandra Barefoot, the creator of the prison program. She kindly agreed to let me observe and participate, with a gentle nudge from Shad, I'm sure. So there I was, back in prison again, this time for the right reasons. It was strange leaving the gates at the end of each day and going for a nice meal with the team. It wasn't that long ago that I was counting down the days to be released myself, and yet I was freely walking in and out of the gates. I remember feeling guilty for the luxury of liberty. As the prison program progressed, my admiration grew for Sandra. I knew firsthand how hopeless prison can be, how difficult it can be to make a change in such toxic environment. And Sandra's work was a ray of hope for prisoners. She had an ability to create safe spaces for the men in the group to express their emotions openly. Without judgment, I began to understand the power of storytelling, the power of safe spaces. Seeing Sandra's work changed my life. I knew it was my calling to help people like me have healthier relationships with themselves, take part in healthier cultures, because as the saying goes, it's hurt people that hurt people. So I continued to share my story and helped facilitate many more programs with Sandra, each revealing something profound, both for me and for the men we were working with. So please, welcome Sandra to the show. It's a pleasure and an honor to have you on Right From Wrong. Before we get started, let's reflect on how we came to meet.
I'm smiling, Jacob, because I just think of those early days. And I remember because I brought you in to Restore, to observe a program first.
That's right.
Because I said, you can't run the program or be with me until you've actually seen it and seen what it's about.
Yeah.
And experienced it yourself. And I feel part of me feels completely privileged. Because I remember you were the same age as my son, if you remember, my eldest son. And I remember we were doing one program and I remember just all these tears rolling down my face because I suddenly realized you were speaking into how your late mother would be thinking of you. And I just thought of myself as a mother with my son, and how when my son was on the edge of the gangs and in trouble, you know, nearly there, and he would say to me, I nearly did it, Mum, but I had you in my head and I couldn't do it for you, Mum. And your journey has been so holding some of that. Your mother with you, I'm going to do this. And she's been with you. So I just remember so deeply impacted by our joining at a time when my son was the same age as yours, and then just sitting alongside you in this journey. It's been epic.
For the benefit of the audience, what is the Restore Prison Program? And I guess a little bit about TFP and how it came about.
Yeah. The Forgiveness Project was set up by Marina Cantacuzino, who was a journalist. And she set it up in 2004. And it was really in response to the Iraq War. And in a way, we're 20 years on now, and we need to be as bold as ever, as Marina was, in looking at what was needed in the world, which was finding the stories of people who had taken a nonviolent response. And it wasn't just the one story. It wasn't those who'd been victims. It was those who'd been perpetrators, if you want to call those words. And so she gathered all these stories together. And then she formed an exhibition called The F Word in the Oxo Tower. And in that moment, it was only for 10 days, but like 10,000 people walked through the door in 10 days because they were desperate for these other stories, that there was another way, not revenge, not retribution. There is another way, and you have to stand in the middle ground.
Yeah. And the F word is a big word.
It's a big word. So it was a beautiful word to use, because of course forgiveness is so sticky. It's so insulting. If you put that in a room, you know, people will say, how dare you put that in front of me, that word. And other people say, thank goodness I found a route to try to heal. So it's just really important for us to place this word forgiveness as an exploration. We have no standpoint. Mm. People say, what's your standpoint on forgiveness? How do you do it? Well, you know, Jacob, it's just that. It's a discussion. It's an inquiry.
Yeah. And it can be given and received, and it can be done for somebody else, but it can also be done for yourself.
Yeah. And I mean, we've had a journey looking at self-forgiveness, and we could say it's the toughest route ever. But just back to Restore. So Restore is the prison program that TFP, the Forgiveness Project, ran. And it started in 2007 as a trial.
Yeah.
And I came into the Forgiveness Project 15 years ago, where Marina said, can you take these big stories to young people? And I said, okay. And then she said, can you go into Ashfield and have a look at this program that we're trying to run in Ashfield and see what needs changing? So this program, Restore, looks at the narrative approach, our sharing of our stories. But these stories are restorative narratives.
Mm.
They're based in inquiry. They're not fixed. They're not motivational. They are living stories, as you know, Jacob. And because it's based on narrative, what we have is three of us, a team of us, who all come in and share our stories. And the program asks us to sit in circle, to consider just listening to a story. Where does that land? What comes up for you? Do you connect? Do you not connect? The discussions that unfold. We have poetry. We look at poetry and visual arts. We look at film. And then we ask everybody to share their stories. And I mean, you know, Jacob, we hold a space where the men will first arrive. Let's look at the men, because you've come into the male program. And they'll arrive, won't they? Agitated. What's this about? Forgiveness Project? Fluffy, fluffy. And is this on my sentence plan? And you're going to write me a letter afterwards? And is this a tick box and all that?
Yeah, I don't do emotions.
Yeah, no, I don't
fuck all this.
Yeah. It's not happening.
I'm not going there.
Yeah, and then arms crossed, you know, proper tight. And in that first hour, we've got to deal with dropping them into a deep space so fast that when they go, whoa, what is this program? Wait a minute. This isn't like any other program. So it's a technique, as you know, and we've had to deal with that a lot, about how do we deal with anxiety and this whole impression.
Of just talking.
Talking about feelings. I mean, men are like, don't you be asking me to share my feelings with you. I don't do that with anybody.
Yeah. And especially not in prison environment.
And in front of other men.
Exactly, yeah. Because that's seen as vulnerable and a sign of weakness, which is what in prison you're not supposed to do.
Absolutely.
And
not.
So it's a 3 to 4 day course.
Yeah.
3 facilitators.
Yes.
Well, you were the lead facilitator.
Yeah.
And then you'd bring in someone who's been harmed, sharing their experiences and how they've managed to process that in a healthy way.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side, you have someone in the course with
who's served prison.
Who's been to prison.
Yeah.
And that's what was my role in there.
Yeah.
Was to come in and work as someone who could share from a lived experience point of view.
Yeah, absolutely.
How to deal with the shame of going into prison or making healthier choices or... breaking the cycle of reoffending.
Yeah.
What do you remember of those early days of Restore when I came in with you?
Well, the first time was you observed, and I remember you saying, "What is this program?" And I got you sitting with the men and sharing your story and in discussion and wanting you to see what your response would be being in prison again.
Yeah, back in prison for the first time.
Being back in prison.
And going back in, I suppose you could say, for the right reason this time.
But what came up was really interesting, even in that first program, because you were talking to the men, you were like, oh my God, I know these narratives. I know the stories they're talking. I used to talk about like this on the wings. You had a real sense also of when the men would go away, you would go out of the prison.
Yeah, yeah.
And would leave them at the end of the day.
We'd go for lunch.
We'd go for lunch and dinner. Yeah. And you'd be photographing your dinner. But you also felt really guilty.
Yeah.
You felt really bad because you know what the men were going back to.
Yeah.
And that was a struggle. And that's been for a lot of our speakers, but it's a struggle, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I had a massive sense of guilt. I don't know why, because, you know, I'd done my time and all the rest of it. But I know what it's like being in prison. And, it just reminded me that I was going home. I had the luxury of having my liberty and being grateful for that.
Mm-hmm.
Just being grateful. I think that's what I learned a lot about from restoring those early days as well. It's just how grateful I was for just being able to do this type of work, being able to come in and out of prison, to have to go home to my own bed. And
I mean, that example, you know, we always had officers in the room and your meeting of the officer.
John, the prison officer. And I got a really good connection with him. And I was like, oh, wow. But then what I realised is I had this resistance to connect with him because he was a prison officer and I used to be a prisoner. And I realised he's just a normal, he's just human. He's got the same struggles as all of us. He's trying to, you know, and he was trying to make sense of his story. And he was in an even more vulnerable position to everybody else because he was the officer in the room and he was being judged more than anybody else.
But he shared his story. You know, this is a thing. And I think, you know, you were shocked like other people is that's your story. You've actually got a story. You've actually lived a life.
Yeah.
And you're going home to that and you're coming to work and we don't know anything about that. And we just see you as an officer.
Exactly.
I remember as well, one of the first times when you shared your story, you know, it's about a punch, right? One punch. And the guys all saying, we've all done that. What's the big deal? You didn't mean to do it. You know, and that was the first response. And I remember sitting there going, here's the first response to Jacob.
They were making excuses for me, weren't they?
Right, yeah. They were. And how did you, do you remember how you responded? I mean, you know, that early days, what your response was.
Because what they would say is, oh, it was just an accident, wasn't it? It's fine. But the thing is, you can't throw a punch accidentally. You can trip over accidentally. But you can't throw a punch accidentally. I didn't intend to cause serious harm, but I did. You know, you can't throw a punch accidentally. And I had to say, you know, I'm owning the fact. I can't let you guys make excuses for me. I'm here to show you that I'm accountable and there's a freedom in being accountable.
The next one was, you only got 2.5 years.
Oh, gotcha.
Hold on a minute.
That's
I've
a
got
lot of 5 years.
A lot of people's reactions were really angry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Why have I got five?
I've got five for burglary. Or I've got five for being caught with a gun. And I'm like, and you killed someone and you only got 2.5 years.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that became a big...
It did.
A big thing, yeah. And I think it still does as well. And that's the one thing, if I still have shame playing up in me, sometimes I feel shameful for the sentence I got.
Uh-huh.
Even though I'm like, well, I know for a fact, for me, in my situation, that was the right sentence to have.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I'd stayed in there longer and been institutionalized further and become more, you know, groomed by the prison mentality and the narrative that you don't take accountability, that you do make excuses, that you... reinforce all those unhealthy criminal values, I would probably never would have taken part in restorative justice. I never would have changed.
And the third thing was, of course, the snitch. And what the snitch represented, you know, the snitches, your friends who were meant to be friends, who then suddenly put the book in and said it was Jacob. You played such a pivotal role for men in that space because everybody in prison, as you would say, and when you were in prison, were living with this thing that I'm going to take revenge on the snitch. I'm going to take revenge on the people. And you sat there with those men just livid going, you've got to get him. You've got to get him. And then you'd say, yeah, but I did it. I did throw the punch. And the look on people's faces and the accountability and you saying the humbleness of you echoing through those men going, wait a minute, but I did it. You can make all the excuses. And yes, I could say, damn, I was in that situation. But the impact was like massive.
Yeah.
I did that punch. I threw that punch.
He told the truth.
Yeah. Yeah, you told the truth.
He broke the moral code of the criminal fraternity in terms of telling the truth and snitching. But in reality, what he did is he just told the truth.
Yeah.
And that was okay. It wasn't okay at the time because I was still caught up with those unhelpful views. But I had to let it go.
Yeah.
Because what was they doing? What was it? Me being angry about him snitching was destroying me.
Yeah, it was so powerful. But then came the film. So when we showed the film of you meeting Joan and David, that 5-minute piece that you'd done with Nottingham.
Yeah.
The silence in the room. And we've got ages of men there from 19 up to like 68 in the room. Silence. A pin could have dropped because they were like, damn. You were so young, and there you are meeting the parents of their son who had been killed from your punch.
And then it wasn't so much about the length of sentence, was it?
And then that kind of lost itself. There was no issue about sentencing. It just suddenly was, how can you do that? And the fear in people watching that, because they knew, how could I ever do that? And the men picked up on the place that you couldn't keep eye contact. Do you remember they said, we could tell, you know, you couldn't hold eye contact.
Yeah, with the parents who were in the video, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember this man, I sat next to him and it was, I'd never forget it. He was 60 years old, served for 30 years violent offending. And he literally spoke for the whole group. He said, I would prefer to serve 10 years than meet the parents of those who I've killed. And he said, and look how young you are, that you could do that. So it's like your level, the respect and the ability for you to have actually gone through something so massive that had a short sentence, but actually you've done, you were doing all of this that none of them were showing up to, or one, some of them really wanted to, because you met, there was another guy as well. Well, there was many guys who had done exactly what you'd done.
Oh yeah, I met a lot of people who'd done 1.6 and I'd have chats with them and they'd say, oh, I've never thought about my victim. And they just say, now I've speaking with you and we've been able to access that a little bit more.
Yeah.
And just having those conversations with them and supporting them to know that we all make bad choices, but we're not bad people.
Mm.
And so essentially it's a storytelling program, isn't it? And you use storytellers from different sides of the coin to help people feel safe looking at their own stories. Why is it important?
How do we make meaning? How do we make sense of where we got to? So your journey, how did you make sense of it? Right? How did I make sense of some of the choices I made that were really wrong, you know, or I have done some big mistakes? I've got to learn in order to find another way. And it's this making sense. And people would say, oh, why go back into the past? But it's like, it's not until you go, okay, so we're with the men in the prison program. They would do their lifelines. We would frame that and they would sit on paper and they'd suddenly look at where they were now. And then they'd look back to when they were 5 or when they were 7 or go, I had never connected these dots.
Yeah.
And I think that is the process of, and the power of looking at story. Our living story is to try to find the threads that make sense as to why I became the person I am today.
But there was one that sticks out to me on that point you make, and it was that young, he was from the gypsy community, and he used to drive through London and he used to look at the buildings as a young kid and go, wow, I want to be an architect.
Yeah.
That was his dream as a little kid, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And he connected that dot of then, and then not being encouraged in education.
He wanted to go to school.
Yeah.
And I remember he wasn't allowed to go to school. He couldn't get to school. And also he was bullied and treated really badly for being a gypsy.
Oh, and I should probably say that the person we're referring to referred to themselves as a gypsy. So we're using that terminology, although the correct terminology would be person from the travellers community. Well, that's just how he self-identified. So we're going with that.
And he was 9, but he was retelling, a proper storyteller, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But the sadness, the grief in that moment, you know, it's like these dreams, these innocence of what I wanted to be, what I imagined, what I envisaged, crushed. You know, how did I get here?
Yeah.
You know, those who were footballers, young men, you know, in Young Offenders, they were there to be professional footballers and then damn, drop, they're in prison, life over. You know, it's like, whoa, what happened? What was this? when we think about that gypsy man, what I think the power of story did for him in that moment was to absolutely announce the dreams that he had, the struggle that he, what he wanted to be. And even though he didn't make it, he was almost putting his whole self together to say, I wasn't just this person. I was this person too. And it's that beautiful quote by Bryan Stevenson who says, we are more than the worst thing we've done. You know, and Helen Prejean, we're more than the worst and the best thing we've done. The thing about storytelling is it puts the whole self back into a frame. And when you're in prison or when you have committed, you know, great harm or you have been greatly harmed, what happens is we orphan off all these other stories. Everything gets fragmented and you've lost yourself and you don't, and you're just seen as a criminal or you're just seen as this. And still to this day, I'm sure, Jacob, you know, well, you did this, you know, it never leaves you those labels, those unwanted identities. But when you get to tell your story, the whole self, you can start to bring parts of yourself back and say, you see, I love this. Yeah. I did this. I was good here. I did this for my
nan. I was an innocent child. I wasn't born bad.
Yes. And this way it goes back to this thing. If you don't get someone, allow someone the space to tell their whole self, how are they ever going to start to say, I can return to something, or I can imagine new possibilities. I can reignite the parts of myself that no one has allowed me to be and to be seen. I'm going to re-nurture that. I'm going to come back to that. You did so much of that speaking your story because you spoke a living story, Jacob. So you arrived in the program and it wasn't a fixed story. It wasn't a story that I did this and this and now I'm all good to go. It wasn't motivational. It was none of that. It was like, I'm living with this every day. I'm having to work with this now in my life. I've got to try and find meaning here. I've now become a father. What has that done for me? So you were showing the men the power of a living story. The danger if we just think the story is done and fixed and finished is we will end up in trouble again.
Yeah. And the benefits then of storytelling art is that you don't overemphasize any particular part of your story. And you can put things into more of a perspective.
Yeah, I think perspective taking is key.
Because you can be consumed by the worst thing that happened to you, can't you?
Yeah, well, Jacob, you know that. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
And how can you not be, right, for some time? I think this is the thing that we have to honour something, that when something so tragic happens in life, it does completely consume you.
Mm.
It completely consumes you. It brings so much pain. It's unbearable. Some people can't survive it. Other people try to shut it down and lock it down. But I think when I look at the journey that you came through Restore, is there was a lot of learning and growing through your life by being in those rooms, being in those programs. You learned so much from the men.
Yeah, and that's what I said in the intro to this episode, was that this process was kind of what gave me that added layer of meaning and gave me my purpose in terms of understanding my story on a deeper level. And sharing it with other men in a safe space, because this is the person that I want to be. I want to put my best foot forward. I want to deal with my problems. I want to restore my past or make sense of my past and not let it keep harming myself and harming other people. And I'm going to seek out those people that are going to help me. And that's what I did.
Yeah.
From that restorative justice conversation, I went up and did that first keynote speech. I've met Chad. He introduced me to you, and eventually the right people come into your path, and you have to have a lot of faith, because I didn't know where I was going. I was like, I know that I've done wrong and I want to make that wrong a right, and I'm just going to have faith that I can do it. And people kind of just found me.
Yeah. I mean, I always say this thing, you know, that we pull people into our lives who we need, right? But some men would say to you, you're lucky, Jacob. You're lucky because you got to meet. You know, so many men want to say sorry. They want to be forgiven.
Yeah. Joan says that she's forgiven me, but David says that he hasn't. And that's fine. And I've said to Joan, I've said, if you decide not to forgive me in the future, that's also fine.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want my growth and my choices and my potential to be defined or limited by whether or not someone else forgives me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm grateful for it. I'm honoured.
And in the program, a lot of the men would come with, I need to be forgiven first, otherwise I can't move on. And you would always talk into that and say, actually, if you're waiting to be forgiven and that never happens, how are you ever going to move on?
storytelling is super important. It helps. We're living our past in the present all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the challenge to our audience, the challenge to our listeners, is to think about how we can help more people make sense of the past, and how we can, whether it's in our workplace, or the cultures that we're a part of, around the dinner table, whether we can have better conversations and create safer spaces for people to kind of talk about things safely. So a lot of this stuff that we're talking about, Sandra, this conversation that we've had, it all kicked off from Restore.
Mm.
What is the future of Restore?
When I think about Restore, I see it as a model in the world for that needs to be everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I used to say, how can we create fountains across the world? And I think the future for me is to really be showing and modeling the processes, the approaches, because they're simple, but the facilitation is the key.
Yeah.
But Jacob, we've been talking about restoring the community for a long time together.
Oh.
Because as the men and the women would say, we're hungry for these spaces.
Yeah.
I mean, Jacob, when you first came to me with the idea that the place of your incident and what happened in Nottingham was where you wanted to run circle processes, for me, I just thought it was phenomenal. Because actually, can we start to hold these spaces where terrible tragedies have happened, or where people cannot, you know, kind of understand how to be in certain areas, or because of the troubles they've caused, can we start to actually place those chairs down, place those cushions down, place those places down where we sit around and have the discussions? And who are the people who can hold those spaces? Because the conflicts we have at the moment and the polarization of people not wanting to hear what's going on, we have to find, and there are many of us out there, and the Forgiveness Project is one of them, right? But there are other organizations. We need to come together and collaborate and say, let's show up with this real complexity and yet simplicity of holding these spaces.
So we're coming towards the end of our time, Sandra, and it's been a pleasure as always.
Mm-hmm.
We always have very deep conversations. And I just wondered what are the lessons for the audience to take from this conversation?
So for anybody listening today, I really would say, if you're needing to understand other people's stories that you may connect with, or that you're really interested to say, I need to find a way, please do go to the Forgiveness Project website. There are 170 stories, there are podcasts, there are videos, there's many resources to look at. Where do I begin? Where do I start to look at finding my way, but also finding my family's way or my whole community way? You know, start somewhere and start being curious and start to reach out. If you can reach out, that's the greatest thing you can do. So that's what I would say. And also, Jacob, I think the thing that I would say is that you stand as a bit of a titan amongst all so many others, you know, one of those oak trees. And I think if listeners can hear this and say, I'm going to pass that on to a son or a man that I know needs to hear this, and especially if those are in prison or anybody you know who is struggling, then hand over this podcast, you know, make sure it gets listened to.
Thank you, Sandra. And again, I'd just like to echo that. And to the listeners, although you're not being heard, I hope that the conversations and the way that we have conversations on Right From Wrong is a space where, in a weird way, you do feel heard, you do feel listened to,
mm-hmm.
and you do feel like you can do the work on yourself, and you don't feel judged, and that you feel capable of being able to make sense of the past.
And there's that beautiful quote. Well, you do. Yeah, you are really exampling that, as many, many people do, Jacob. But you do. And we always use this quote in the Restore program. And it's from Maya Angelou, the late Maya Angelou. And she would say, history, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived. Yet if faced with courage, need not be lived again.
Next week, I'll be talking to veteran actors Julie Hesmondhausch and Tony Hurst about what it was like bringing my story to the stage. Be sure to give it a listen. This podcast was produced by One Fine Play. Matt Cheney is series producer. Kazra Feruzia is the editor and writer. Thanks also to Selena Christofides for help with the visuals. I have been your host, Jacob Dunn, and this is Right From Wrong.